We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Welcome to the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast. Yes, this is not John McKechnie talking. It's like Joe Bartle filling in for John today. I am joined alongside by the normal co-host, at least, Mario Puig. Mario, last time around, you guys were talking about what I could only assume was a mutant insect that had now invaded your apartment. Should I assume that you have been consumed by this almighty mosquito dragonfly bug, or are you safe and sound?
No, it's planted in my spinal cord, though, and every once in a while it takes control of me. So if the podcast cuts out, it's like we're trying to wrangle my, you know, function, my mental capacity and functions again. But it's been a few days, and I don't know. I think they're actually just mayflies or something like that.
Is it a lake fly?
I don't know. I've lived in this part of Madison for a while now, and 3 or 4 years, and I don't remember seeing them. Maybe there's just something new happening on the lakes this year. I don't really know, but it sucks because they're these big stupid flies, and they just hang out on my screens, and I get paranoid about opening the windows because I'm afraid they'll get in, eat me and my stuff. So it's just kind of I don't like bugs is the thing. I'm really bad about bugs.
I'm not a huge bug person at all, but I'm gonna do my pushes up glasses and talks in a high voice kind of situation, because I did grow up, we have a cottage near a lake, my family does at least, so I'm well accustomed to the lake flies. And I think obviously Lake Winnebago is not anywhere near Madison, but the same thing applies, where the algae was pretty strong in past years and caused the lake flies to be so aggressive. Maybe that's a scenario that we are seeing here in Madison, and you were just apparently recognizing it for the first time. That's my only guess. Why?
Yeah, people are often talking about algae, and I never know what it means or what they're talking about, but maybe – I'm gesturing my hands in the air and just saying algae. It's the algae.
It's the algae.
Might be that. I don't know. But yeah, I guess my struggles with the insects of the area don't really compare to what not to trivialize it, but now that you're okay, it's kind of okay, I guess, to chuckle about your situation, which was somewhat more harrowing than mine.
Yeah, I guess slightly. For those of you who don't know, and I really didn't make it aware on Twitter, but I've had a lot of people either text me or message me on Slack, and this is how this conversation came up, because, Mario, you did this as well. that I actually had my appendix removed 2 weeks ago on Tuesday. And there's a lot of unfortunate things about it, but this is my first major surgery, and I really put that in quotation marks as best I can while talking, because it's...
That's a real surgery, dude. That's a real surgery.
It's a useless body part, as I was informed at the ER. So. But the thing with it, when everyone talks about an appendicitis or getting the appendix removed, they're in severe pain, right? Like that's the whole thing about the appendix surgeries, that it's severe pain. I had none of that. Absolutely none of that. Like, the lead up to me going into the emergency room was mainly me trying to avoid going into the emergency room during a pandemic. That was my biggest concern. Like, on a pain scale of 1 through 10, I was in the 1 to 2 range, to the point where my wife, thankfully she convinced me to do this. It was like, if you have a fever, then you have to go in. Otherwise, I was not going to. So at some point Tuesday, the symptoms had all started on Monday, and it was over a 24-hour period that I was like, well, okay, maybe this isn't indigestion or constipation, which I thought for sure. And in fact, I went to McDonald's and I got coffee, which are normally my two biggest, all right, we'll get things moving through just fine. And neither of those worked. So that was the first, like, maybe something is up. And then the fever happened later on, to the point where I was, all right, we'll go into the ER. Again, no pain whatsoever. And then as I'm sitting in the Madison emergency room for the next 6 hours, we finally had a surgeon come in. I didn't even have a doctor pop in. The surgeon said, hey, so I'm not sure what they've all told you. And to that point, no one had said anything to me. I had already gotten like a CAT scan done and a few other blood work things. We're going to have to cut out your appendix. And I'm like, oh, okay. So like, is that something I can schedule later? I'm like, no, you need to do it now. I'm like, oh, okay. Wow. So like tomorrow morning? No, like we're going to get you in like now. So for like 5 o'clock when I had went in central time here in Madison, I was just anticipating, well, you know, they're going to rule out everything else but that. But it became apparent that I needed to have my appendix removed. So that night around 1:30 or so was when it finally got taken out. And honestly, Mario, I was probably in more pain post-surgery than I was beforehand. So we were in the hospital, my wife and I, for the next, you know, I think it was about 20 hours or so. I got out late that next day and had been recovering. So anybody that normally listens to me do the podcast on Fantasy Bites or anywhere else, there's been a reason at least as to why I haven't been able to upload anything lately. And I'm glad I can finally join you now. And I've been doing a lot of other work for the magazine and on the site too. So we're all set and fine. I stupidly tried to, you know, do a little bit of a run yesterday. I normally like to run, especially during the pandemic where you can't do anything else except I feel like exercise very, very alone outside. And that was that was a poor choice. I probably shouldn't have done that, but otherwise I'm moving just fine and there isn't any complications from that.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you're okay. That's a kind of insane story to me. but yeah, I guess be careful about those stitches or whatever you got there.
Yeah, the 4 incisions are still, you know, I'm still aware of them, but again, it's more one of those things where if I take a wrong step, then I feel it. But, you know, for the part that freaked me out the most, I mean, obviously if you're told, all right, surgery in 2 hours, that's a little bit freaky. But I was really hoping to avoid taking the COVID-19 test. And I've long since told people that if you really wanted to protect the American public, just show them the test, like the physical model of it where they shove that thing in your nose and it's meant to scrape the back of your brain or whatever it is, because that freaked me out just seeing that. And I wanted to completely avoid everything related to talking, touching, or anything near people, so I would never have to have that happen. And they just snuck it in there at the end. They're like, all right, you're gonna have surgery. And then this doctor comes in like 5 minutes later, all right, so to make sure you can go ahead and have your surgery, we need to make sure that you're fine, so let's go ahead and do the COVID test. I'm sure you've already done it before. And I'm like, no, I have absolutely not. This is...
Wait, they had a turnaround that fast? I thought it took a couple days.
No, well, so the test itself, so the to do the test, it was very quick,
right? Thankfully.
But the within hours, yeah, I got the results back. It was 3 hours. They said it was going to only be an hour, but I was in there waiting for 3 hours.
What the hell? That's crazy. No, I mean, I know they're already doing these things in Madison. Like, there's a big local science industry, and I think that's played a role in them getting these public tests that aren't available in other states. But yeah, I thought those take always 2 days. I mean, I'm glad there's a faster one. Right. That's just I was like, yeah, because I assumed it would be like you get in your situation, and if they test you for that, then they're kind of like, all right, now you're going to stay in this room for 2 days. and we're going to take you to a different room, and the results depend on which, or, you know, the results will tell us which kind of room you go to.
That was the plan. If complications arose during the surgery, that's what they'd have to do. And you know, it's fine. And again, at some point, it was just like, all right, I'm so tired. I just want to get this done with, because we had been sitting in the ER for probably eight or nine hours before we really got to that point where surgery was on the table or that we were going to do it. But, it was a whirlwind, and I was freaked out about the surgery, but then the test freaked me out way more. So when it was done, I was ready to go. Like, all right, I've passed the hardest part of whatever tonight was going to be, in my opinion, was that COVID-19 test. And for as bad as it looks, and it looks really, really freaking scary, it was not as painful as I was anticipating. And I am definitely a weakling. I mean, like, I don't want to go to the dentist. I don't mind getting shots or poked into me, but I certainly prefer not to. So something like that really freaked me out. It was not as bad as I was anticipating at all. Like, my eyes watered a ton, and, you know, it really felt weird for about 5 seconds, but that's all it was. And I likened it to, if you were to get like a strep throat test or something like that, you're going to swab the throat there. And I hate when that happens. That was the same sort of version, except for the nose.
Nice. I'm not trying to one up you, but that test will be easy for me, because sometimes on the radio listeners or the podcast listeners will say to me, like, Mario, your voice is so cool. I wish I could listen to your voice, because it sounds so normal and good and soothing to me on a recording. But just like, what's wrong with your sinus? And I say, like, oh, actually, my sinus is completely destroyed. And like, I was just born that way. I've had like chronic sinus conditions my whole life. And one thing related to that was that I had a sinus surgery already 6 or 7 years ago or something, because I was at a doctor for another reason, and they did a CT scan or something and saw like a mass in my skull, basically. And they had to do an exploratory surgery to make sure it wasn't some sort of tumor or something. And it wasn't a tumor, and not to disgust anyone, but it was like a giant collection of just like infectious waste because of a really bad sinus infection that I had, which I'm prone to. And to do that surgery, they had to like rip up my sinus a good amount to get up there. And then they put this sponge thing up there to, I guess, prevent scarring accumulation. And it was not a dissolvable sponge is the thing. So it was like this horrible, like, it was like a tampon, basically, that was like crammed into my nose/skull. And there was this tiny little string that the guy pulled out after like a week after the surgery with a tweezers that he was bad at handling. And this is not like a tampon that fits well through the nasal canals. It's like pulling a couch through like a tiny door or something like that. And really disgusting. And I think it's like after that particular experience, I'm ready to have lots of things jammed up my nose, including Q-tips.
See, this is exactly the reason why I have not felt comfortable talking about my appendix surgery, because there was not a lot to it.
That's serious stuff. I mean, yours was more serious than mine. Mine, it turned out there was nothing up there, but basically like fossilized pus or something.
Yeah, but that's gross. And that's painful.
It's gross, it's not like, you know, they didn't have to like cut me up. They just jammed things in my face.
Well, there you go. You come for the fantasy football knowledge. You get the complete dissertation on both the nose and mid-region of the body. Here you go. So, yeah. So this is my first time back doing a podcast for that. I've been working a little bit last week, too. So I'm happy to get back on the grind. And the thing that I was most disappointed about was that actually it was a big time for esports 2 weeks ago. The NBA 2K League had just launched. We've been doing a lot of different coverage, especially during the pandemic, from the esports perspective. And one of the many titles I have here is esports editor. So I was pretty disappointed that I couldn't be partaking in that, but I've of course since been able to get back on the grind, so that's great. And you know, thank you, listeners, for sticking through to the for all the medical dissertations that we just gave throughout that. But let's actually get to the fantasy football perspective, and obviously there's still a lot up in the air in terms of when the NFL season's going to start. And I feel like at times since the draft and really during the offseason portion, the most we've really had to discuss is like jersey changes and what teams look good for their new stadiums next year. And I hate partaking in that conversation. I'm not sure if you are a jersey guy necessarily, Mario, but
I don't really care.
Yeah, okay, good. So I'm the same way, but we do have at least a little bit of information that we can work towards from a fantasy perspective. Starting with, I thought, a decent enough relevant take that Raheem Mostert has added additional weight or muscle to his body and is looking to get closer to 200 carries for next year. If that's the case, and you're more the projections guy than I am when it comes to fantasy football, is it possible that Mostert gets a little bit higher value? I mean, he handled close to 190 carries last year, including the postseason, so I don't see it making a huge difference from a fantasy perspective, but maybe you see it differently.
Well, this is one of those things where I'm not sure what everybody else thought in the first place. I'm not quite sure what they think now either, but I kind of assumed Mostert was heading toward that 200 carry sort of range. Not likely to go far past it with that said, but I kind of just assumed that was the nature of the San Francisco running game going forward. You got obviously Breida traded to the Dolphins, so you just got Raheem Mostert, who of course ended this last year on a tear, and you have Tevin Coleman at the second running back, which with McKinnon apparently Jerick McKinnon apparently still not even cutting on his that knee with like it's like a new sort of disorder basically. Like I don't remember a guy having so many setbacks and procedures of sort of unspecified nature over about 2 years now as McKinnon. So I don't know what's going to happen with that third spot. And if it's not McKinnon, if McKinnon's not basically the player he used to be, then whoever the third running back is probably a good bit behind Coleman, let alone Mostert. So if they don't add anybody, and I don't know why they really would, then Mostert kind of has to be the lead back. And maybe because he's a former wide receiver track guy, and maybe because he's only around 200 pounds, maybe that means he doesn't get more than something like 12 to 15 carries a game. But you would think, especially the way that the two ended last year, you would think that Mostert would basically be the running back they go to when they want to move the ball and score points. And maybe Coleman would get a lot more of the reps when they're more so trying to get out with a win once they get a lead. So they could be interchangeable in some senses. And I still think Coleman is capable of quite a bit. Like, I don't know how some of the blocking that Mostert got on some of his carries, I think it's safe to say, was just better than a lot of the looks that Coleman got, even if Mostert is safely better. So I think Coleman is capable of especially more like long plays than he showed more 40 plus yard carries than he showed in San Francisco last year. So I expect him to kind of stumble into those sort of outcomes, even if he is a backup. But Raheem Mostert tends to go, I want to say, in that like late fourth, early fifth sort of range in best ball drafts so far. And I think he can be fine there, especially in best ball, especially when those spike weeks matter so much. But I wouldn't get my hopes up for, you know, more than that 200 carry sort of range. And I would let go of the idea of him averaging like 6 yards a carry again. I guess he could, but some of those plays that he got last year, there was just wide open blasted, you know, tunnels for him to run through. And he's always going to be fast. He's always going to take advantage of those plays. It's just, I don't know if he'll get quite as good of a setup as last year. So I'd expect some per touch regression, but the touches going up, And the fact that that team should have a good defense, should be in scoring range quite a bit, should be in run favorable game scripts. Mostert should have a bunch of the higher scores at running back this year, even if he kind of fluctuates a bit.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up the open holes and everything else that comes with that San Francisco offense. I feel like the defense in the NFL is almost overreactionary from a year-to-year basis. You look at Matt Nagy's offense, Trubisky, I think his second year, right? He was a super relevant fantasy quarterback, completely floundered last year. The Rams' offense seemed to have been figured out by the Patriots, and then that was kind of repeated by every other team the past season. I don't know if that necessarily happens toward a running-specific attack like the 49ers, but just recent history makes me a little bit more concerned that you could see somebody or see a team really figure it out, quote-unquote, how to stop that rushing attack. Although the Shanahans for, what, 20-plus years now have been able to do this with every sort of running back. So maybe it just is something that is intangible to them, whether it be Mike or Kyle.
Yeah, and Kyle has a lot of his kind of ideal personnel at the moment too. So sure. It's not just that he has better ideas generally than a lot of the coaches. It's like he'll never have more ammo than he does right now. And especially a guy like George Kittle changed so much of the complexion of the offense because he's largely the most important player on that offense because he, depending on where he lines up and depending on the way he motions on a given play, it forces the defense to tilt with him, and Shanahan uses that a lot to kind of create misdirection, you know, like basically use George Kittle in motion, use George Kittle on a drag route this way to hand the ball off to Deebo Samuel going the other way, stuff like that. And, you know, all those plays fold into other similar looks in the playbook, and different things occur within those similar looks. And he sequences a lot of plays to kind of set up the defense to wander into a trap. And it's that the trap might be the Kittle cross, the Deebo jet sweep, or it could be kind of like a wide zone toss to Mostert or one of the running backs. And when Shanahan gets his really good plays going, when he really gets on a roll, it's basically because the defense is kind of like twisting over itself and going the wrong way every time. So when you have Shanahan arranging those outcomes, then pure speed will pretty much always kill. And Mostert has that. So he has it. Coleman has it. I think they'll both be pretty productive on a per touch basis. But the other thing is like Mostert really might be still improving. He might be getting better kind of all the time, even though he's 28 or 29 or whatever, because at Purdue, he was basically just a track guy and a wide receiver. And for some reason in his first couple, 4 or 5 years actually in the NFL, he was largely a gunner more than anything else. So it was weird that he never got more of a look at running back because he is burning fast. He's definitely a really fast guy. And usually when someone's stuck on special teams, it's because they're just kind of like one dimensional or an overachiever type. But Mostert's really fast, really quick, always has been. And Shanahan's offense pretty much always creates space.
Support for this podcast comes from U.S. Bank. If you're looking for a credit card that fits your lifestyle, look no further. U.S. Bank has credit cards that make every day rewarding, no matter what you're into. Feeling hungry? Check out the U.S. Bank Altitude Go Visa Signature Card. Earn 4x points on takeout, food delivery, and dining. And get 2x points at gas stations, grocery stores, and on streaming. That'll keep your wallet and your mouth full. Big spender? The U.S. Bank Visa Platinum Card has a low intro APR for large purchases or balance transfers. And you call the shots with the U.S. Bank Cash Plus Visa Signature Card. Choose 2 categories each quarter. Earn 5% back on your first $2,000 of eligible purchases from those categories. So don't just get a credit card, get the right card to make every day more rewarding. Cash back, merchandise, travel rewards, and low intro APRs are waiting. Learn more at usbank.com/creditcard. The creditor and issuer of these cards is U.S. Bank National Association, pursuant to a license from Visa USA Inc., and the cards are available to United States residents only. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
There's another player that I know you're probably higher on the most last year, and I felt like you're able to pay some dividends on him. We saw Preston Williams, of course, of the Dolphins, reported that he isn't quite yet back to participating in on-field actions after he had surgery to his ACL tear in November. He's kind of gradually jogging. Apparently, he's doing the Joe Bartle appendix recovery technique and kind of working his way to that point. You look at the Dolphins and everything that they improved over this offseason, and of course, some would say, well, yeah, you kind of have to improve when they had as little talent on that roster as they did last year. But I think there's some noticeable action, whether it be at the quarterback position and likely Tua starting at some point down the road, the offensive line making a pretty significant dividends, and even to the defense as well, getting a lot of different pieces throughout the offseason and the draft. Is this a situation, if you can assume Preston Williams is going to be 100% healthy at or whenever the NFL season starts, that he's a guy that you can draft where he is currently going at his ADP?
Give me a second to look up his current best ball ADP because I'm not totally sure. It looks like he's going in the the late to mid 12th.
Okay.
I think that's right. He's going there around these guys like Golden Tate, Curtis Samuel, Robbie Anderson, Justin Jefferson, Jalen Reagor. So in that particular range, the only one of those guys that I would put alongside Williams is probably Golden Tate. Maybe Reagor, but probably not quite. I don't know. I am a Reagor fan. I feel like I'm guessing completely the way that they might use him this year, and I'd like a little bit more reassurance from the coaches, because with Williams and Tate, you know how they're going to work, basically. A little bit different of the players, but you more or less know the deal. Williams, I don't want to pretend to know the medical aspects of this like intimately, but being in week 9 as an ACL tear, that's just late enough in the year where I'm a little bit creeped out by it. I think if you pick him, you have to be prepared for maybe a slow start. Although if the start of the season is delayed at all, that could just as easily be, you know, more recovery time for him. And the more time he has to recover, the better, generally speaking. So he was getting targets right away last year. And I was not quite high on him after his pro day, actually, because he had a really disastrous pro day at Colorado State before the draft. But before his pro day, yeah, I actually kind of was pretty high on him because he was a 5-star player at Tennessee, was probably going to be good there, but he had character issues resulting in him getting booted from the team, went to Colorado State and drew something insane, like 170 targets in 13 games, which is just crazy. So he looked on tape at Colorado State like the 5-star guy. Like, he looked pretty fast, especially for that Mountain West sort of competition. He just looked like – he basically looked like Randy Moss compared to those guys. And but then with that pro day, I was worried that he kind of just, like, fell on the character issues because he tested terribly, and I assumed it was because he was out of shape because he looked athletic on tape at Colorado State. And there's been guys like him in the past, like Speedy Noyle and God, I don't even – like, other players like that who, you know, were blue-chip recruits – kind of had character head case issues, produced here and there, and they still just like disappeared in the NFL. And I was worried that Preston Williams would be another case like that. However, either he was kind of like a non-indicative sort of tester, like the pro day numbers basically were trash, like non-indicative or something, or maybe he really was out of shape and just kind of like got back into shape in training camp and became the player he was on the tape again. I don't really know, but he was getting targeted right away, even as an undrafted guy, even on a team that already had Devontae Parker. I think Albert Wilson was ready for week 1. I can't remember for sure. Had Allen Hurns there. So Jakeem Grant, they were making manufactured touches for, and still Preston Williams got on the field. So if he's healthy, I think he's going to right away be like that sort of, you know, frequent jump ball target of Ryan Fitzpatrick's, and especially the way Fitzpatrick plays the game. So yeah, he should be fine if he's healthy, and that he's so young bodes well for his ability to recover in time. But yeah, I'd probably prefer someone like Tate over him just because I feel like I'm getting something solid. Whereas once you're comparing him to Robbie Anderson and Curtis Samuel, maybe that's when I start buying Preston Williams again in redraft.
Okay, so Tate, then Preston Williams, and then Jalen Reagor, and then you see the Panther guys below that is kind of the ranking that you're thinking?
No, I would probably put Tate first, and then even somebody lower than that, probably like Sammy Watkins, who's way later than them.
Gotcha.
But this is the general range. It's like that 12th round range. The two secondary receivers in Carolina, Anthony Miller, Golden Tate, Preston Williams, those are the kind of guys that are going off the board on best ball 10s at least. And in PPR scoring especially, I would prefer Tate out of that group because I just think you know what you're getting with him, whereas the other players are more speculative and ambiguous, I would think.
I think I'm a little bit lower on Preston Williams too than at least that ADP that you were suggesting. But I almost wonder if the Dolphins offense and team overall is just going to be better where there isn't going to be as many situations for him to benefit. And I think he's
That's a good point.
You know, like I certainly think he's a talented player, and Devontae Parker, I would imagine, continues or at least gets close to whatever we saw his breakout was last year. But if Ryan Fitzpatrick is not the quarterback for 16 or 17 games or whatever it is, I don't think that's going to happen. I'm a little bit concerned, and I think the defense is going to improve. And the AFC East, that division overall, is just garbage compared to everyone else. I get it, the Bills are pretty good, but the Jets aren't anything special. And the Patriots, we have no idea what they're going to look like with their new quarterback, Jared Stidham, or we assume to be the quarterback. I just think there's going to be a situation for the Dolphins to improve or at least do well enough offensively and defensively where Preston Williams maybe doesn't get the amount of targets and looks that we saw last year when they were just flailing offensively or trying to catch up most of the time.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually, because the game scripts for the Dolphins last year were basically, like you said, because the pass defense would fall apart right away and the run defense too would fall apart right away in every game. So they'd fall into a catch-up mode, and that might help explain why Preston Williams' target rate per snap was as high as it was. Part of it is probably just that he's like a good receiver, but it was pretty high. And, you know, Fitzpatrick being the kind of quarterback he is, he was definitely the type to kind of just chuck it at his tallest receiver because he's not that accurate, and he's just kind of a chucker that way. But with Byron Jones signed from Dallas, with Xavien Howard healthy, with Noah Igbinoghen, however it's pronounced, drafted out of Auburn. They also got they did something at safety that I can't remember. But anyway, yeah, their defense should be a lot better. They added those corners. They added Kyle Van Noy at linebacker. They added Shaq Lawson. And I want to say they added Emmanuel Ogba at outside linebacker. So they're going to get a lot better results on defense this year, whereas last year they probably were the worst for a bunch of games.
Well, they cut Rashad Jones, which might be an addition by subtraction situation too. At safety. That might have been what you were thinking of, too.
Oh, I'm not sure. I actually still thought he was good. So if they cut him, I'm just going to pull up the depth chart because I know they moved Eric Rowe to safety is what they did. He was playing corner last year. Gotcha. They were playing like Eric Rowe and Nick Needham at corner last year and some like Jamal Wiltz or something like that. And now they're going to be Xavien Howard, Byron Jones, Noah Igbinoghen, and probably a couple other guys who are better than last year too. So that defense will get a lot better. They added Brandon Jones in the third round out of Texas too. So I don't know if he'll be any good, but they added a lot of ammo on that defense. And like you said, they won't be as desperate to throw the ball to catch up like they were last year.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where I'm thinking, at least with Preston Williams. I thought it was at least interesting with this health related thing that we could bring it up. All right. Well, again, not a lot of major news happening throughout the given week. So I know you and John have spent the majority of the time in the past two episodes or so discussing different dynasty options or really kind of embarking more on the second-year wide receiver trend and seeing who could really break out. I want to build off of that with today's episode and kind of focus or feature a little bit more of the keeper dynasty questions that we've been getting a few from our users, as well as some that I might have for you. So great lead into that actually is our dynasty owner sponsorship here. And the best fantasy football leagues are those where every owner constantly pays attention, responds to trade offers, changes their lineup, and are always looking to improve their team. There is no off season for these owners, and that's who you're challenging yourself against in dynasty owner, other elite fantasy football players who are committed to competing. Dynasty Owner is the only fantasy football platform with a patent game used actual NFL salaries and contracts. Combine this with a salary cap, elite trading options, advanced team rosters, and the devoted elite owners to compete against, and you're facing some same decision NFL owners and general managers might make. If you're ready to take on the best, then don't miss out. Join the waitlist at dynastyowner.com. All right, so great jump into really our topic that we're going to focus on today. There's a few names that I sort of threw at you to start the podcast that we discuss, and I think, at least from my perspective, I want to hear your opinions from a dynasty and keeper league. On Baker Mayfield, of course, he was our cover boy last year. The Browns did a lot of things, I feel like, to improve their offense, but I would have said the same thing last year. And right now, I almost feel like so many people are burned by Baker Mayfield that he might not be as intriguing of an investment as maybe a Daniel Jones or Josh Allen or maybe not Sam Darnold, but like those younger type of players, where I think Baker has a chance and certainly has everything around him to really be what we thought he could be last year. Am I crazy to think that?
I don't think so. I think you can both believe that Mayfield was overrated as a player last year and still believe that A, he'll be good, and B, whatever he turns out to be, particularly, he will at least be a fantasy value at his current sort of price, because at his current price, he doesn't even really need to be that good. And of course, with some quarterbacks, I guess you could think of Jameis Winston last year, especially in leagues that don't count turnovers, you can get a quarterback with bad on-field, bad real-life results and get good fantasy utility out of them. And Mayfield, I think, in this kind of setup, as long as the offensive line is improved, which I feel it has to be for a couple reasons, not just because they added Jedrick Wills and Jack Conklin at tackle, but also just because it's not Freddie Kitchens' team anymore.
Right.
And I don't know how to explain it exactly, and I can't imagine how something like this happens, but Freddie Kitchens, as best as I can tell, was basically a head coach last year despite not knowing how to run a basic practice. And what I mean by that is I feel compelled to assume that because I've never seen a team, never seen an NFL team look just as completely unprepared as they were. It was like they would struggle with things that you would think would get addressed in Wednesday practices of the week. It's as if they played like they did not practice. And it was especially bad on the offensive line, where they would just fall apart in just baffling ways from a variety of alignments and variety of different ways, different parts of the field. You saw it show up repeatedly. It wasn't just Freddie Kitchens' play calling that was questionable, in my opinion, but like their execution in the goal line situations, I think, had a lot to do with this, because it was just an example of kind of isolated football task, you know, goal line sort of drill. Like basic drills they weren't capable of kind of playing on the field, let alone elaborate play structures and you know, broader disciplinary issues. So they looked like it was like they were practicing the way the water boy South Central Louisiana State played in their practices. Like Coach Fran was Freddie Kitchens' assistant last year instead of Todd Monken, in my opinion. So that's the kind of scale of the dysfunction with the Browns last year. And I think literally any other coaching hire would have helped make that better. And I think Kevin Stefanski, especially if he really kind of soaked up the lessons of Gary Kubiak and if he really took them correctly and understands them and is prepared to apply them deftly for himself going forward, then that should be uniquely helpful, because Kubiak, of course, is part of that Shanahan tree where they kind of just make running easier on themselves with some of the blocking principles and the motion setups and things like that. So Stefanski was basically tutored by Gary Kubiak last year in Minnesota, and now he's going to try to implement some of those things in Cleveland. So I think they would have been better for those reasons. And then, yes, Jedrick Wills and Jack Conklin should be a lot better than Hubbard and whoever the other Greg Robinson was. Yeah. It was last year Greg Robinson.
I would try to erase that from my mind, but yeah, I think so.
So yeah, it was really bad players and the worst coach ever, and those two conditions no longer are the case. So that's good for Baker Mayfield. And my personal take on him at this point was, like, I probably overrated him going into last year, but he still did what he did as a rookie, and that was on a team that was also dysfunctional. It's not as if the Hugh Jackson, Todd Haley year was some sort of golden era. It wasn't quite as bad as Kitchens' was. And yet Baker Mayfield still had good numbers that year, and there was no Odell Beckham on that team. There was no Austin Hooper. And so I think there's quite a few ways it could get better. The main thing that limits my enthusiasm is that I do worry a little bit about the injury proneness of Odell Beckham at this point. And part of Baker Mayfield breaking back out would I would feel better about that if I knew that Odell Beckham would be fine. But it's looking kind of like a dicey thing. Like he could be fine, and he will probably be really good if he is. It's just he's probably not going to be an always healthy kind of player. Like, it seems safe to say he won't be that anymore. And with that comes plenty of risks. And aside from that, they're probably going to be a two tight end offense rather than a kind of air it out. You know, this is not going to be like at Oklahoma with Marquise Brown and D.D. Westbrook and Mark Andrews in a spread formation. It's going to be a two tight end offense with David Njoku, Austin Hooper. There might be mostly kind of underneath passes when it's not going to Beckham downfield. So the big plays won't be there, but there could be, you know, a cut down in turnovers, a big uptick in completion percentage, a lot less pressure, things like that. So the Cleveland offense should be a lot more healthy, and he should be able to get into kind of scoring range with fewer turnovers to get there. So those are the ways I think it'll balance out. And I wouldn't get my hopes up for kind of like a top five quarterback season, but I think he's like, I would take him over Matt Stafford. And on Best Ball 10s the past week, Stafford's been going higher. So I think people are getting a little low on him, as understandable as it would be given how bad, you know, the optics last year were.
Yeah. And at least from a dynasty and keeper perspective, there's a clear six, right? It's Lamar, Patrick, Kyler Murray, Deshaun Jackson, Russell Wilson. I think Dak Prescott deservedly belongs in that conversation. But after that, I still feel like there's a lot of question marks for the Josh Allens, the Daniel Jones. Carson Wentz is in that conversation too, although a little bit older than that group. And we have Joe Burrow also ranked among that. And then Baker fits into that category. Like, I know Jerry Donabedian's been doing a lot of tiered related articles, and it's been great content on the site. And I wonder if that kind of tier is where Baker could really move up, and he can be that top 12 quarterback from a dynasty or keeper perspective, or a top six, top seven. Because I know you're not super high on Josh Allen. I'm not super high on Josh Allen, but there are certainly fanboys out there for him. And I think that's kind of like the range of outcome we could see for Mayfield and his value long term.
Well, I think Allen is fine in fantasy just because he runs so much. But yeah, I would put Allen in Carson Wentz ahead of Mayfield. I probably got to put Daniel Jones ahead too, just because he's going to run a good amount. And Mayfield can run, but he's more of like a sneaky runner, scrambler runner. He's not going to get designed to carries a whole lot, and he's probably not going to be very good at it if he does. So those combined with the two tight end offense and the questionable long speed of that offense, those are some things that could limit his upside, whereas I would say the runners have more upside, and Wentz I just think is probably better, probably on a better offense, so I would put him ahead. But if you're talking like the guys who don't run, the guys who don't project to be in up-tempo, high pass attempt offenses, then yeah, in that 10 to 12 range, Mayfield should be a safe contributor most years going forward, I think. And he'll probably have a couple years where he's like 6 to 8. But unless they add some speed to that offense, and unless they kind of go with more of a 3 wide than a 2 tight end, I'm not really convinced that there's going to be a whole lot of big box scores this year. Like, I think he might be a guy who hovers between like 18 and 24 points, or more the Kirk Cousins kind of tier, I guess. I don't know. And Kirk Cousins, as much as people give him bad press a lot, like, he's been a good fantasy value, like, basically every year. So maybe Mayfield kind of falls into that territory with, I don't know, maybe he's at the higher end of the Jared Goff, Jimmy Garoppolo, Kirk Cousins sort of tier.
Okay. All right, there's two other questions that I get quite frequently, or I see on our Ask an Expert feature on the site, which is available to all of our subscribers, and you could ask questions related to baseball, basketball, really anything. I've gotten actually a few esports-related questions too, and I don't think the people are asking them know I'm the one answering, so it's kind of crazy to see. But the two other players that I see asked about quite frequently, I think had their value lessened because of the NFL draft. And I'll start first with the obvious one, Aaron Jones, of course, running back for the Packers. A.J. Dillon being one of a number of confusing selections for the Packers, and I could say that as a fan of the team. In the second round, it seems pretty clear-cut to me that the Packers are not intending to re-sign Aaron Jones to a long-term extension. His contract is up at the end of the year. If Dillon becomes what they wanted Eddie Lacy to be when they drafted him a number of years ago, and really is that feature back, especially in the cold weather and tundra field, every kind of, everything else like that, I just don't see a scenario where Aaron Jones comes back, and that's where maybe his keeper dynasty value is less than where we would anticipate given the season he had last year.
I think it's possible. I mean, this is a very obvious thing to say, but it's possible that they let Jones go, but I don't think it means for certain that they will. I think it means it's the kind of thing they'll see it as. It leaves them more freedom to lowball Aaron Jones as a free agent, and I think they'll try to re-sign him. And I think Matt LaFleur basically might want to be trying to emulate the Tennessee offense, which was obviously Derrick Henry centered. And A.J. Dillon, incidentally, is a lot like Derrick Henry. And I know people are going to say things like, oh, you cannot compare anyone to Derrick Henry. But a couple things quickly. Derrick Henry was not a popular like hype pick. Most people thought he was bad up until, I don't know, 14 months ago or 18 months ago, whatever it was. Even going into last year, even a month and a half, 2 months into last year, Derrick Henry still had his haters chirping in full force. So when not many people really hyped Derrick Henry to begin with, like, don't act like he was some sort of deified figure before he arrived like he did last year. Like, a lot of people, I was surprised, and I was a Derrick Henry hype man the past few years. So if it surprised me, then, you know, A.J. Dillon being like him is a possibility that people should take more seriously, and that they don't really think it could happen itself is not really a good argument, because he's 6'2", 247. Derrick Henry is 6'3", 247. A.J. Dillon is more dense. That's preferable. At 4.53 40, that's faster than Derrick Henry's 4.54 40. Now, A.J. Dillon didn't put up the ridiculous 2,000-yard season at Alabama that Derrick Henry did, but he did put three big seasons up at Boston College, where they basically didn't try to throw the ball, so there was no there wasn't even like a Blake Sims kind of quarterback. There wasn't who was before? There wasn't Jalen Hurts. There wasn't anything like that. It was just A.J. Dillon versus the defense, and he was really good. By the way, it wasn't just the 4.53 40. It's like 41-inch vertical, the broad jump, insane numbers, and especially for someone as big and densely built as he is. So you can look at the tape at him at Boston College. He ran away from defenses. He runs over people. He's quick. He's shifty. People miss him when they're trying to tackle him. there is a worst case scenario with all this said. Like, TJ Duckett was basically all of these things, and he wasn't a great player in the NFL. But there's also the Derrick Henry case, and we've seen how it can work. I think that A.J. Dillon, at the very least, even right away, will be a problem for Aaron Jones's red zone production, because he had 16 rushing touchdowns last year in the red zone. 16. And – or sorry, 14, my bad. And that's just one of those things. Like, A.J. Dillon is 6 foot 247. He is faster than Aaron Jones at that weight, at 30 pounds or so heavier. NFL teams, football coaches love big running backs in goal line situations. They just do. Even ones that aren't as fast and as explosive as A.J. Dillon, even the ones that aren't half as fast or explosive as him, often get favorable treatment when it gets toward the goal line in the short yardage situation. So at the very least, A.J. Dillon is a wrecker threat to the value of Aaron Jones. However, A.J. Dillon in college never really caught the ball. I don't mean to say like he can't do it, right, but we don't really have any evidence that he does. So particularly in that sense, there could still be an opening, because Aaron Jones is pretty dangerous as a pass catcher, and that's one way for him to stay involved that A.J. Dillon can't imitate. So we'll see. There's stuff like that going on, and I just kind of think they're headed toward a more ball control, run-heavy offense, because they basically punted at receiver, and I just think they might be trying to put it on the ground instead. But A.J. Dillon's arrival point blank means Aaron Jones is not scoring those touchdowns next year, and he probably wasn't going to score them anyway, because it's just, you know, variability just kind of works like that with touchdowns.
Right, and I think Jerry actually outlined it. I keep giving him name drops. Jerry should be paying me by the mention for this podcast. But Aaron Rodgers is likely due for a little bit of touchdown regression, the positive nature, passing in the red zone, and maybe he ends up throwing a few of those, one or two, to Aaron Jones, which could offset some of that. But I have to agree with what I was looking at, and I think maybe a guy like Jay Sternberger, or even any one of those receivers that they hope to anticipate, or they have to at this point, develop to something more, could be a bit more of a passing threat. But it's pretty clear that Aaron Jones was the focal point last year, and it's, at least history-wise, suggests he couldn't do the same thing again from the red zone, and A.J. Dillon could also take some of that away too. But all things considering, I think that was one of the biggest drops from the NFL draft, from a dynasty value, at least from a guy at the top, because I just don't think, whether Jones comes back or not, I just don't know how they could, especially if he chooses to operate that offense like the Tennessee Titans from yesteryear, and I say that jokingly because it was only like 2 years ago when he was doing that, I just don't see a way where Aaron Jones can really be a prolific late first round, early second round type of talent in redraft or in dynasty keeper leagues with the situation that seems to be imminent.
Yeah, I mean, I have no shares. I don't plan on getting any. And for what it's worth, going back to a week ago in the Best Ball 10 ADP, Aaron Jones is at 11. And I remember he used to be more at like 8 or 9. So he has fallen a bit. And namely, he's going a bit later than Nick Chubb, who he tended to go ahead of him before the draft, not when I was picking, but that was generally the case. And I don't know if Chubb has gone up at all, or if it's just like he's by default moved up a spot because Jones fell down. But Jones at 11, I mean, I understand why someone would want to go with him, especially if their strategy is simply take a certain number of running backs in the first three rounds. And if he's the best one on the board and that's your strategy, then I can't really argue against it. Like, he might be the best one on the board a lot of the time. But generally speaking, I would rather have Tyreek Hill, who goes the pick later, the next pick. And I'd rather have even Julio Jones, I think, who's going down at 18th. So I'm pretty low on Aaron Jones, not as a player. I think he's a really good player. And I liked him coming out of UTEP. I mean, I was one of those people who said, like, he's clearly a better player than Jamal Williams, who they took a round earlier. I was surprised at just how good Jones was last year, but a lot of it was just objectively lucky touchdowns, and that luck will probably dry up anyway. And A.J. Dillon presents quite a bit more possibility of bad luck that wasn't otherwise just due to, you know, regressing to the mean.
The final name that I teased a little bit earlier about, guys, I've heard a lot about from other users and just from a fantasy perspective and the community out there, that could see a bit of a decrease, is Amari Cooper. And I know that's crazy to think about, but I'm a little bit worried about the Mike McCarthy offense, and maybe it's just the jaded Packer fan of me that is concerned about, but also what CeeDee Lamb and what I think CeeDee Lamb can be and will be as a pro, what that means overall for the Cowboys offense, right? At some point, they've transitioned from this very, very, very Zeke-heavy attack to now there's a bit more passing involved, and of course, Dak Prescott and his contract negotiations. I feel like there's going to be a motivating factor for him, Dak, maybe not so much the team, but for Dak, to really do some things from passing perspective as well. And I just feel like Cooper might be the one, not odd man out, but I mean, really the contract that he got basically only guarantees 2 years with the Cowboys. At that point, they could cut him and not really take much of a cap hit. So it's a two-year sample here the rest of the way where Cooper could still be a top 15, top 10 talent. But I think the CeeDee Lamb pick might have hurt him a little bit more than people might anticipate.
Yeah, it's a tough one because I think Cooper's really good. I know some people just kind of don't like him. I think he's really good, and I don't want to put unfair expectations on CeeDee Lamb to match or be better than a player who could be one of the 10 best receivers in the league, in my opinion. So it's one of those things where the risk that CeeDee Lamb presents to Amari Cooper is pretty clear. And you're right. It's something that his owners should probably think about. But I don't quite want to assume that CeeDee Lamb will do more than what Randall Cobb did last year. Like, I think he will, but it's unfair to expect a rookie, any particular rookie, even if it was, you know, AJ Brown. It's like, it's just not fair to expect a rookie receiver to be as good as of a player as Amari Cooper is. And that's not even to consider the complications that, you know, maybe Michael Gallup is getting better still too. Maybe he'll be a better player this year than he was last year. Don't really know the way it's headed, but that team does have a cap crunch pretty clearly. I don't even understand how they've gotten this far with everybody on the books that they have. But they already lost Byron Jones. Jerry Jones has a way of kind of getting the Cowboys into these cap messes where they have to blow up a lot of the team. And if CeeDee Lamb is, you know, 85%, 90% as good as Amari Cooper at that 2 year point, like you said, then Dallas might kind of have to go away from Cooper. Like, it might not even really be up to them. So we'll see. But the only thing I really worry about with Cooper in the meantime, I guess, is maybe his durability. Like, he was getting nicked up quite a bit last year. And if he's nicked up, then, you know, even if he's still playing through it, he's probably not as good as Gallup and Lamb completely healthy. So he might disappear for bits at a time, even though you get that, you know, Sunday morning notification. Like, he's active. They say he's going to have a full workload. It's like, even then, he's not going to be the same guy that he is when he's healthy. And those two are so good, they might just be better that particular day. So there's a lot of volatility there. If you take him in redraft or if you have him in dynasty, you need to be kind of resigned to the fluctuation from week to week with Cooper. He'll probably always be a volatile guy that way. But I wouldn't really be rushing to move him or anything because he's still young. He's been in the NFL a while, but he's probably only like a year and a half older than like a Van Jefferson or some other older rookie receiver, because Cooper was really young when he came out of Alabama. But as far as where he tends to go around, I don't know what player. Like, I would probably have to say I'd probably have to take Cooper over someone like Odell Beckham in dynasty, just because I just don't know what to make of Beckham's like injury history, and don't know what to make of Baker Mayfield exactly. Like, Cooper is a really good receiver and he's got a really good quarterback, and that's kind of a lot to work with just right there. So depending on the sort of part in your team's trajectory you're at, like whether you're in a rebuilding phase or if you're going all in, that might help determine how you evaluate Cooper for your particular purposes. But yeah, aside from that and like your appetite for risk, those might need to be your tiebreakers, because it's kind of hard for me to let CeeDee Lamb be the reason that I get rid of Cooper, because the other thing is Gallup will be a free agent after this year, and I don't think they're going to resign him. So if Dallas is, you know, 3 years from now with Cooper and Lamb at receiver and Dak Prescott's still there, everybody who didn't trade Cooper now will be glad that they didn't.
Yeah. And you know what? That's a good point too. I had read a, I thought it was I don't know if it was from, you know, you do this all the time too, but I got to do this as well. I don't know what source it was, but I thought it was from one of the Cowboys affiliates of some sort, whether it be a beat writer or something to that extent. And it was kind of outlining how you could have Cooper, Lamb, and you can have Michael Gallup. Man, I don't know why we were blanking there. On that roster also next year too, and it would require a franchise tag from the Cowboys' perspective and maybe a cut or two as well that would free up the space. I didn't necessarily read that article and thought, okay, it has to be Cooper or Gallup, and they made their choice this offseason. It's Cooper. I read it more like, okay, in 2 years, if Gallup gets to the point where the Cowboys think they could get him to, and what we've kind of seen from a developmental trajectory, then Cooper becomes where he just gets dealt or cut or something else. And cut would be really tough. Like, his contract really is actually fairly affordable for a receiver as talented as you and I both think he is. I just have a scenario that I could see that Gallup ends up getting hurt. But there's another name too, like Blake Jarwin. I know you're super high on. I think he's going to be a relevant factor as well. At least he's better than the carcass that was Jason Witten at tight end. Like, there's just so many options from the passing attack perspective that I feel like the Cowboys could feature. And they still have Ezekiel Elliott, who they're paying a ton of money to, and really has been the heart and soul of that team for quite a while. And I just imagine from an ego perspective, Zeke isn't going to be able to just let the passing attack be the main focus anymore.
Yeah, I guess the way I see it generally is I would not be especially eager to move Cooper in a dynasty league. Like, there's always exceptions, and if you get a good enough offer, and if you can't really use Cooper in the next couple of years anyway, then in your situation, you might want to trade it more than someone else in some other situation with Cooper. But as long as Dak Prescott's there, and we also have reason to believe that a pretty solid offensive line will be there for the next couple of years at least, then I think it would be one of those things where you keep the good players from the good offense because these things have a way of working themselves out. Like, I think Zeke will get fewer passing game reps, specifically fewer targets, perhaps. Like, maybe a bit of Lamb's production is subsidized by taking away a little bit from Ezekiel Elliott in the passing game. Maybe he's reduced to more of like a 20 carry, two or three catch kind of running back instead of the 20 carry, three or four or five catch running back that he's been the past couple of years. And maybe Ezekiel Elliott gets hurt. And if he does, then all of Cooper, Gallup, and Lamb might all of a sudden start going off. So as long as Dak is there, it's like we have reason to believe the Cowboys will score a lot of points. And it's not ideal that there are so many players capable of scoring those points, but you're better off with the hand that kind of includes one of those guys than any particular player from most other teams, I guess is how I see it.
Yeah. Fair enough. And I just think it's a good conversation to have, especially when it comes to how many options they have there. But I'm right there with you. I'm not really trying to discount Cooper's talent at all. I think he's a tremendous receiver. You just look at the financial perspectives on a few of these teams, Cowboys one of them, and you wonder, how does it all make sense or work out? Maybe it ends up being that Gallup is just gone next year, and I could entirely see that too. So it's good conversation and something that, at least from a keeper and dynasty perspective, I always love talking about that and always love answering questions too. Well, that does it for us on the RotoWire NFL podcast. Hopefully next week John will be back and the regular dynamic duo can return. But it was great talking with you, Mario, and fun breaking down some NFL.
You too, Joe. Thanks a lot for stepping in, and you know, glad you're doing good putting your talents forth for the pod, because we needed the help, and we're glad you could give it to us.
Doing what I can. That's all I can say. Doing what I can. All right. Until next week, best of luck to everyone.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.